be entertained by it. If I fall on the floor for about a minute laughing and coughing and trying to get to the water, just enjoy it. But about 2 years ago, a flush-faced student raced into my office at New College, University of New South Wales, thrust into my hands a copy of this novel, The Da Vinci Code, and said, "Read it, you'll be out of a job." So I took this quite seriously, since there aren't really many openings for Christians on secular campuses talking about Christianity and apologetics. So I took him very seriously and I read the novel that weekend. But I have to say, I know I'm in a minority here in global terms, but it didn't do much for me. To be honest, I thought it was a fairly run-of-the-mill murder mystery. Had some good pacing early on. I was very put off by the instant appearance of the albino assassin. I think if he hadn't been an albino, maybe I could have been more on board. Surely this was just another airport page-turner, another novel that would be in the bargain dustbin within a month or two. Well, I was intrigued, however, that the novel contains so much religious history. There are pages and pages, if you read it you'll know, of teaching from one character to another, Sir Lee Teabing, the great Grail historian, teaching the other characters about the history of Christianity, the history of the early church, how we got the Bible, various discussions of medieval pseudo-Christian sects. Why all these history lessons in a murder mystery? Why would this kind of novel be popular? Surely it wouldn't. Well, I met with my friend a couple of weeks later and suggested to him that the novel was really built on some speculations about ancient history that we've heard before, some speculations about Jesus, a bit of use of the historical documents that were found in the sands of Egypt in 1945 called the Nag Hammadi Library, but there was absolutely no way it was going to become popular and influential. He didn't need to worry about it. Well, I've never been more wrong. The novel's just crashed through all the publishing records that we have, spread wildly across the world. I think it's 44 languages now that you can read The Da Vinci Code in. It's being made into a film as we speak, starring Tom Hanks, out next May. One of the best-selling novels in history. My job was not in jeopardy either, because since then, every 10 days or so, I've been somewhere talking about The Da Vinci Code. It's just taken people right to the heart of Christianity, what it claims, whether it's believable, what you're going to do about it in the contemporary world. In fact, as far as I'm concerned, it's a book sent from heaven. It came down from heaven as a gift from God for people like me and you to be able to talk to our friends about the Jesus we believe in. Now, apologies to anyone who finds that blasphemous. I'm not suggesting that really God provided this book and it is a holy writ, but this book has given me more opportunities to talk about Jesus in different contexts than I can ever remember from any other sort of cultural circumstance. Now, the Da Vinci Code is not actually alone in putting Christianity squarely back on the public agenda. And it's fascinated me that in the last few years, the pop culture seems to be Christ-soaked. The Passion of the Christ, what an extraordinary success that movie had around the world, reviving public interest in the gospel accounts of Jesus, no doubt introducing some people to the story of his crucifixion and resurrection for the very first time. Some people will have found in that film their first encounter with the story of Jesus of Nazareth. I heard unchurched postmodern people asking questions about the meaning of the resurrection for the first time after that film. As we speak today, the film of C.S. Lewis's children's fantasy, The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, is in production. It comes out in December. Has anyone seen the trailer? It's on the web. Yeah, I only discovered it last night, actually. Looks great. The central story of this children's tale, for those who haven't read it, is the atonement for the sins of a boy by a lion. It's one of the best allegorical representations of Jesus' death and its meaning that I know of. So again, in the next 6 months or so, well on into next year with the film of The Da Vinci Code, the message of Christianity will be up in lights for all to see. So it would seem to me that we're in an extraordinary time of connection between popular culture and the very central concerns of Christianity. Who Jesus is, whether we can trust the Bible, what Jesus' death and resurrection actually means. Surely this should be a golden age for apologists, a golden age for those who want to explain their faith to others, want to seek to explain their faith, defend it, and promote it. Well, yes and no. Yes and no. See, while pop culture has Christianity on the agenda, as do politics, as you've been discussing in the last couple of days, as does education, as does bioethics, we're also at a time where the Christian worldview, as traditionally understood across nearly 20 centuries, is collapsing, and in some places has in fact collapsed. In what we might roughly call our postmodern era, many previously received aspects of Christian understanding of the world are just considered defunct, discredited, unworkable, indefensible, and downright offensive to many of those in the sections of Western society, particularly the sections within which we work. Beliefs such as the Bible is the word of God, God will judge the world, God created the world, are almost nonsensical to much of what we might call the cultured population. Worse still, they are beliefs which might not even have been heard of or read. And we have to realise how extraordinary this is to be in that context at the end of 20 centuries of Christianity, where in some of the largest groups in society, the message of Jesus has not been heard or read, such that they can go to a film and that be the first time they hear of Jesus, or read an airport thriller and hear the name of Jesus for the first time. So we are a long way from a society that has shared a Christian worldview. And I take it most of us work in that kind of climate. So to take just one example in more detail of that problem, the view that God dwelt in human form in Jesus Christ, the incarnation as we call it, might now actually be considered quite quaint in many contemporary societies, a quaint idea. People will still sing at Christmas time, "Veiled in flesh the Godhead see, hail the incarnate deity." But they might as well be singing "Shup Shup Diddy Wobby Op Bamboo" or whatever the words out of that song. You know, it's meaningless. They're meaningless words. Does anyone know where that comes from, by the way? Can anyone name the artist? Oh, right, now you're too Christianized. Now, I was going to give a prize if anyone could, because I watched Spicks and Specks this week, and it was mentioned on Spicks and Specks. Monty Video and the Cassettes. One Hit Wonders from 1982. Yeah, there you go. No one wins the prize. You won't even know what it is now. But to many, the idea of the incarnation just seems like an illogical idea, a nonsensical idea, an incredible idea, a superstitious idea, a redundant idea. And yet, this doctrine is central to understanding who Jesus is, why he can be trusted as the revelation of God to us, why his death matters, how it is he rose from the grave. To be a Christian, you've got to have a grasp of this idea that Jesus is God in the flesh. So, to me, it seems like there's this long bridge from the Christian worldview to a common worldview today. Maybe there isn't such a thing as a common worldview today. But it does seem correct to say that it's often the case that when a Christian explains what he or she believes, the eyes of the average postmodern citizen glaze over. However, I'm here today to ask that you do not give up hope. I found enormous hope in the phenomenon of things like the Da Vinci Code and other things I'll talk about. And I sense there are some shortcuts across the bridge. And I was just thinking about that image on the way here. I'm not sure it really makes sense as an image because there aren't really any shortcuts across the bridge. But there are some ropes you can swing across, or there are some cars you can hop in that will take you faster across that bridge from the Christian view of the world to where your friends may stand, to where your family may stand, to where your colleagues may stand, the kind of view of the world that they have. And in the rest of this talk, I'm going to focus on some of those shortcuts because I believe that many of them lend themselves quite naturally to those who work in the media. They're shortcuts in the areas of culture, and it was fascinating to hear on that video of the work in Christianity and culture that's being done on campus, in the areas of culture, in ethics, in what I would call sideways approaches to Christianity, sideways approaches to helping people understand and make sense of the message of Christianity. Because what does an apologist do in the postmodern age? I sat in my office a couple of years ago when I was first employed and thought, well, what do you do? How does an apologist work? Where does someone who is concerned to reconnect the world of today with the world of Christianity, believing they're separate, where do they begin? How do you go about your work? Well, in a sense, that's the sort of question we're trying to answer in the project of CASE, and I hope you'll look at the material we've got there and perhaps consider grabbing hold of the magazine. Because we're trying to map out ways you can put into practice those connections between the intellectual worlds of today and the intellectual world of Christianity. I suspect the questions are similar on university campus to the ones in the media. The theory is going to be similar. But I'm really interested in hearing what you have to say about the different contexts of media and university work. As Dominic said on the video, there are various gatekeepers in society. In the media, you are one of them. On the university campus, we are another. But I think we work together. We need to work together in order to be doing our work at the optimum level. And I'm trying to grow Christian academics and train them and help them, as they help me, to approach their own work within the Christian worldview framework. And I need help from you, I think, to explain that work to the larger population. So you're in a very significant position to me. I'm really thrilled to be able to talk to you today and hopefully begin to make those connections. So do you want me to finish at 5:30? Keep going? Okay, yeah. Hopefully we'll have time for a few questions at the end that can start to make those connections. Yeah. Now, I'm just going to disappoint you by racing through some slides I decided not to show you. Dan Brown, documents of the Da Vinci Code's based on. Mel telling Jesus how to get agonised on the cross. A scene from the upcoming Lion, Witch and the Wardrobe, the sacrifice of Aslan. It looks amazing. I'm not sure my kids can see it, actually. I think they might need the story rather than the images. The bridge. And here we are. It's a very boring slideshow from now on. I just didn't have time to work through that. I think that apologetics is three things. Apologetics is three things. And they're in your title. It's defense, it's attack, and it's attraction. It hasn't always been all these things, but as I've tried to conceive of it for today, I think there are these three prongs to the apologetic fork that we need to explore. The first is the defense of the Christian faith. That is, defending Christian beliefs, saying they are true, that they make sense, and that someone is warranted in believing them. That's what I see as the defense of the faith. That it's true, that it makes sense, and that someone's warranted in believing Christianity. So it comes from the Greek apologia, which is a word for the defense, the sort of legal defense that you would make for a case. And that really has been where most apologetics has taken place down the centuries, in this defense of Christian doctrines. It's an important task. That's our first task. We'll come back to these. Secondly, the attack. It's also the job of the apologist to attack views of the world which we understand to be false and to undermine Christian belief. Now, here in Sydney, we developed over the last decade or so a project called Kategoria, which comes from, again, the Greek word for courtroom behaviour, where you were making an accusation of someone. And there was a great journal, which I was involved in, which folded and finished recently, called Kategoria. The aim was to critique other views of the world from a Christian standpoint. It can sound fairly kind of nasty and negative, can't it? But really, it's an important intellectual job to be able to examine the foundations or the expressions of alternative views of the world to Christianity, and as a Christian, see whether they stand up. That task, I think, is also very important to apologists, to those who want to do this work in the world. Not all other worldviews are entirely incompatible with Christianity, however. We need to be careful here that not every element of another worldview needs to be attacked. There'll be plenty of points of contact and similarity between worldviews. In that attack mode, an apologist needs to be specific rather than broad. That is, for those who like military analogies, to use heat-seeking missiles rather than the machine gun. to target the aspects of a worldview that need to be critiqued. To those who are on the more pacifist side, what do I do there, left and right? Yeah. To those who use a less violent image, it's hand weeding, not crop spraying. You like that? Maybe not totally environmentally sound as an illustration, but hand weeding, not crop spraying. It's less violent unless you're a weed, I guess. You've got to focus in on the aspects of these other worldviews that are in conflict with Christianity. See whether they make sense. If you don't think they do, explain why that's the case and why Christianity seems to work better. The third prong in apologetics is attracting people to Christian belief. And here's where I'm really excited about the new kind of project we've got at CASE, attracting people to the Christian faith. See, if we only defend the faith, if we only attack other worldviews, we will still be entirely useless. Because the message we have is one we want to draw other people to. It's a message we want other people to receive. We want to invite others to the spiritual feast that we have found in Christianity. The real life we've found, the meaning, the hope, fulfillment that we find in Christianity. We want to attract people to the view of the world that we think is true. And I think there's an enormous area of opportunity here, and this is one of the great shortcuts across that long bridge towards where people are today. People are attracted to the person of Jesus. Have you ever heard anyone say a bad word about Jesus? About Jesus the man, Jesus the person? I tried to think of anyone I'd come across who would say, oh, Jesus, you know, what a loser, I'd never follow his teaching. Have you ever heard a bad word about Jesus? I saw a great interview with John Cleese, Monty Python fame, where he was talking about when they made the film The Life of Brian. Own up to having seen it? Yeah, it's not always a certainty these days, because, yeah, getting along in the tooth. He did this great interview where he said they'd started out trying to make a film that made fun of Jesus. They wanted to parody Christians and parody Jesus, the one they followed. They worked and worked at it, but they just couldn't make fun of him. He had too much integrity. He wasn't even like a Ned Flanders kind of Christian. No, he was so attractive. So they decided, well, they just have to have an alternative Messiah, Brian, who was mistakenly the Messiah. They could make fun of him, someone who was running away from the claim that they were the Messiah. But Jesus was just impregnable. He was just so honourable by anyone's standards. So people are attracted to Jesus. And it's that attraction, I think, that we need to build on today. So I'm really enjoying these mixed metaphors today. There are the three-pronged fork with which you'll cross the bridge to towards the non-Christian's worldview is the defence of the faith, the attacking of other worldviews, and the attraction of people to the person of Jesus Christ. Well, a two-minute digression into extreme apologetics. So I'm really not doing well on giving you my PowerPoints here. All right, there's the apologist in the corner. Extreme apologetics. So, when I started this job with apologetics in its title, I was very reluctant to accept the word. Not only does it not make sense to people really outside of Christianity, you know, you're apologising, what are you doing, what's it all about? But it also conjures up for me images of hot-headed, waistcoat-wearing, never-smiling, obsessive people. Do that for you? I don't know. The kind of person who is so obsessed with the details of Christianity and so wants to convince you that they're right that they will forget that they're talking to you in the process. Apologetics can get very heavy. And as it does so, I suggest its value actually diminishes. So I wanted to just give you this brief warning about the way apologetics can go and the problems of getting too involved in apologetics. I'm not suggesting that these things I'm going to talk about have no value. I'm talking about the obsession with certain styles of apologetics. There's four of them. Firstly, the argument-heavy approach. That's the person who wants to provide rational arguments for belief in God, or normally for the existence of God, or for various Christian doctrines. Now, this has been a concern of philosophically oriented Christians since Justin Martyr in the second century, and it perhaps climaxed in the Middle Ages with Thomas Aquinas and his his proofs for the existence of God. It's still very popular today. I think it's very valuable, and especially in philosophy faculties at universities. The process of thinking through the rationality of the Christian faith is very valuable. However, formal argument is going to lose most of your audience within the first few minutes. It's just not the way most people think. They may at some points in their life need it, and there may be some people for whom it's essential to their faith. But by and large, if you give all of your focus to getting the arguments right, you still won't do the job of bringing Jesus to people. Secondly, there's the evidence-heavy approach to apologetics. I call this Josh McDowell-itis. Those who know Josh McDowell, a wonderful apologist of major influence in the 70s and 80s, developed together the evidences for the Christian faith. Many of you will have read his books, Evidence That Demands a Verdict. I've read them and benefited greatly from them. But there's a kind of evidence approach to Christianity that just starts to wear on people, where you are so obsessed with gathering and securing the lock-solid nature of the evidence for Christianity that it starts to look like special pleading. And I think postmoderns are very sceptical of special pleading, very sceptical of anyone who is trying too hard to dot every I and cross every T in their explanations of their faith. I quite like Lee Strobel's approach to this evidential apologetics, where he doesn't necessarily present the evidence up front, but does it in interview form with people. It's a very clever way of cutting the circuit. The problem there with evidence-based apologetics is to put it in a personalised context in form of an interview. A very clever move. I often go to a website called infidels.org, which is not about Muslim-Christian relations. It's actually a site for those who want to do anti-apologetics to attack the claims of Christianity. And the great delight there is to take down evidentialists, is to show that the evidence really isn't there if you use certain criteria, or to worry away so hard at the particular evidences until they look like they're just paper tissue falling in the breeze. So that kind of obsession with evidence doesn't seem to help either side. Don't get me wrong. I think evidences for Christianity are very solid and very important. But if you obsess with them, you still may not be doing the job of an apologist. Third extreme apologetics, I think, is the personality-heavy approach. And this is where apologetics is only driven by the persona of the apologist. The kind of people who like doing this often are reasonably charismatic people, have some sense of mission, some sort of program for what they're doing. And sometimes with those powerful, persuasive people, the actual culture of the apologist gets in the way of people hearing the message. It's just a personality cult, I hear people say, about strong Christian leaders. It's just a personality cult. You're just following. There's some problems there too. And the last extreme issue, I think, is the culture-heavy approach. And this is a new approach to apologetics. I'm quite excited by the prospects of connecting contemporary culture with Christian thinking, but some apologists do go overboard trying to find the Christian angle on everything. I think Christians have a lot to say on most things, but looking for the Christian themes in The Incredibles may not be the way to win people to Christ. So there's a point at which you can be going too far down the line of saying every element of culture is an opportunity for laying Christianity out in front of people. Again, don't mishear me. I'm a real supporter of cultural approaches. I think we should use film. I've already indicated that to you. We should use music and literature. We should use politics and ethics as opportunities to explain the Christian worldview. But if it's done excessively, it can be indulgent. All right, well, back to our main points of defend, attack, and attract. I won't read all of these because of the time, but I've looked in the scriptures to try and find the biblical approach to apologetics and decided at this stage I think it's piecemeal. I think there are lots and lots of different approaches to apologetics. And certainly these three of defending the faith, attacking other faiths, and attracting people to Jesus fit well within the scriptural material. So the defence you'll find in the quote from 1 Peter 3:15. Always be ready to give a reason for the hope that you have. To give a reason for that hope that you have in your heart about Jesus as the Son of God and the future of the world as you understand it. I wanted to come back to using the incarnation as a way of to explain to you how you can use the incarnation in each of these areas. As I said, that's one doctrine that people may find just fanciful these days. But in these three categories of defend, attack and attract, I think we can illustrate how you might approach the issue of the incarnation. So let me do that very briefly. For those who are defending the faith, the incarnation is not illogical. It is not illogical to claim that Jesus could be both divine and human. The philosopher Spinoza complained that it was like trying to say that Jesus is a square circle, you just couldn't do it. But he was wrong. Divinity and humanity have no logical problem between them. There is plenty of mystery and fascination in putting them together. But for someone, in defending your faith on the incarnation, you can point out there really isn't a logical problem with Jesus being divine and human. They can both be true at the same time. Secondly, does the Bible support this approach of attacking other faiths? Well, yes, it does, in a careful way. And you'll be familiar, I think, with this passage from Acts 17, where Paul's at the Areopagus, talking with the leaders there about at their invitation about his view of God. Now, I chose this view. You can read it while I'm speaking. That'll save us some time. I chose this view of this section of the Scriptures to illustrate the attacking mode because I love the gentleness of Paul's attack here. Really, he is offering an attack on pluralism. He's offering an attack on their worship of many gods, even an unknown god. But it hardly seems like an attack. Paul is forthright. He clearly attacks a number of points of their worldview, the unknowability of God, attack on agnosticism. He attacks idol worship, which I think is an attack on materialism. And he attacks unbelief in the resurrection, which I see as an attack on naturalism, the view that this world is all there is, that the cycles of life and death are all there is. But it's a wonderfully gentle attack, shrouded, clothed within the understanding of who God is and who Jesus is. That kind of attack, I think, is extremely powerful in getting people to change their minds. So on the topic of the incarnation here, how would you attack other views of divinity in the world? Or you might attack the view that the body is unfit for divine occupation, as the Gnostics thought, and many people think today. What's wrong with a connection between the divine and the bodily human? Where's the issue? You might attack the idea that God has no contact with the world, as many scientists will assert today, the kind of deistic view that God, if he started things off, has retreated a long time ago. No, for us, God came to inhabit the world. That's what the incarnation is about, God's habitation in the world. So intimate is his love for us, so much does he want contact with us, that he would come in human form. And our final category is attraction. Now, I think this might be wrong in your handouts. It's 2 Corinthians 2, 14 to 16, not 1, 14 to 16. My mistake. But this part of the Scriptures teaches us that the knowledge of Christ is a fragrance. It's a smell. It spreads throughout the world. Similarly, apologetics gives off an odour to attract or repel. It gives off a perfume. One that those who are willing to believe will find attractive and others will be repelled by. We have to make sure people are recoiling from us for the right reasons, not just because of their rejection of us. If they are repelled by our message, it must be a rejection of Christ, not of us in our methods. And I love the summary of attractive apologetics as taste and see that the Lord is good. This is the way to attract people to Christianity. Look at Christianity. Look how it works in the world. Look how it makes sense of relationships. Look how Christianity makes people content. It ought to. Look how it makes us better people. It ought to. Look how it makes us more loving, more at peace. If it doesn't, it ought to. Because those things will attract people to Christianity and be part of the apologetic task. You may never have thought of them as part of the apologetic task before. But people will be attracted to the goodness of the Lord if they see it in his people. Now, this is the kind of attractive apologetics that I think is taking place when we talk about the Narnia books with someone and the opportunities that will come up in the next few months as this movie comes out. Or it's the kind of apologetics that's taking place when you write a piece about an admirable Christian leader who somehow explains why their faith undergirds their life. Or it's the kind of apologetics that takes place where you line up the Christian teaching on forgiveness with perhaps the Islamic teaching on forgiveness and ask the question, which seems to solve the human dilemma? Which is more attractive? This kind of apologetics, I think, is very useful to those in the media because that's the kind of world that you work in. It allows you to approach Christianity from the side, through the Narnia film, through a discussion of other religions, through a biographical piece on a Christian leader, to come to the discussion of Jesus from a sideways path rather than straight through the centre. Now again, on the issue of incarnation, how would it work to explain the incarnation to someone using a kind of attractive apologetics mode? Well, you might say the attraction of this idea is that human beings are acceptable to God. It was acceptable that Jesus came in human form. There's nothing to stop God inhabiting the world. And that may lead on to a discussion of our own sinfulness and Jesus' sinlessness and the difference between us and him. Secondly, you might say, well, a consequence of believing in the incarnation is that Jesus identifies with us. What an attractive idea that Jesus, who came from God, would identify with us in who we are. We're not alone. He knows us. He knows you. He knows what you're going through. He knows the trouble in your life. He knows the temptations you face. This is a repeated theme in the New Testament, that Jesus knows us. And I think it's a very attractive one. And finally, on the incarnation, what about just the intrigue of this idea as an apologetic angle? What a fascinating idea. What if God were one of us? Just a slob like one of us. I mean, you don't have to work very hard, do you, to get from pop culture to the question. It's there in the song. The question that, what if God was one of us? It's a question about the incarnation. You dive in. All right. Well, I need to finish up. I want to finish with a few little personal comments on the character of being an apologist in whatever setting you're in. If you have opportunities to talk about making sense of Christianity in your own context in the world, you're an apologist of some sort. And often we talk about the theory of apologetics, but not so much about the character of the apologist. So I'm just giving you five statements here that I think you ought to keep in mind as you consider how to do this. They're very broad statements. One, remember all three nuts in the pod. There's another metaphor. Remember all three prongs of the fork. The defending, the attacking, the attracting. If you find yourself just interested in one of those, maybe you need to spread your wings a little bit. If you're someone who loves the argument to pursue to the nth degree the rational basis of what you believe, just check you're not going too far there and actually working against your own purposes. Maybe there are some elements of attractive apologetics you could build in. Secondly, we need to broaden our ability to connect Christian thinking with the world out there. And here, of course, I advertise my own centre's work because that's what we're trying to do. Connect the world out there with Christianity. How do you do that? It requires thought. It doesn't necessarily come naturally as to how you put it together. And another bit of advertorial. I just thought I'd show you an example where I was really happy I managed to do this, I think. I had this bizarre opportunity at the end of last year on Christmas Eve to write the Christmas editorial for the Herald. Julia Baird had fallen sick or had something else to do. And via Margaret Rogers, actually, I got a call from her to, she said, look, you've got an hour. Could you write the Christmas editorial? I had an hour because it was the day of our Christmas party at work. I was going bowling in an hour. I had to get it in before the deadline. And anyway, I had these ideas running around my head. I just read a story by Tim Winton, Australian novelist, called The Turning. A very wonderful story about a woman who's has a conversion experience to Jesus in the most extraordinary circumstances while she's being raped by her husband. And I had that in my mind. I also had these thoughts about the superficial nature of Christmas cheer, of the the idea that, now's the time we deck the halls, we'll give a bit of money to charity. I was just feeling really cheesed off at the kind of tokenism of that. So I somehow managed to blur these things together in an hour into a piece that used pop culture to attract people to the person of Jesus, who I described in terms of U2's song of getting into the trash of life. No matter how trashy your life was, Jesus could be there. This woman's being raped by her husband and she sees Jesus in a snow dome, this kind of tacky snow dome that someone had bought for her. And she has a moment of clarity where she realises she needs him. And it's just this extraordinary story. Anyway, that got through and I was just thrilled that was in there as an example of the kind of way you can merge together the world out there with your own Christian thinking. I encourage you to try and do that sort of thing wherever you get the opportunity. Thirdly, practice humility. It's not necessarily the strength of people who enjoy apologetics to practice humility. They're often very sure of themselves. We often want to make sure others know that we're sure of ourselves. But we need to practice it in at least three ways. Is it a phrase I love called epistemic humility, which means just being humble about how much you know. You're not God. You've got limitations to your mind. You're not even as smart as everyone else in this room. There's limitations to what you know. So some humility in your knowledge is actually a very attractive thing to someone who you're talking to. Moral humility. How often are Christians accused of being hypocrites? And that's the end of the apologetic discussion. If you are open about your own sinfulness, open about your shortcomings, you may make a lot more progress in your apologetic activities than if you are pretending to be on some sort of moral high horse. Just be in the gutter where you belong and people might listen. Thirdly, political humility. And by that I mean letting other people hold their views. Some Christians seem to try and trap other people in their discussions, so they've got nowhere to go in discussion. I don't think this is the end point of apologetics. The wonder of the Christian message is that it is there for people to accept or reject. This is extraordinary that the God of the universe would allow people to reject his own son, but he does. So we ought to also allow humility that lets other people hold their views and make their own decisions. And that can be hard. Your speech has to be gracious, seasoned with salt. Your confidence in God's sovereignty and prayerfulness as your final solution to persuading people of the truth of Christianity. Fourthly, we're playing the man and the ball. The woman and the ball, sorry. The phrase just doesn't work. Playing the man and the ball. Apologetics is about arguments, evidence, persuasion, debate. It takes seriously the human ability to reason, to change your beliefs if you're given evidence or arguments to do so, and to make decisions about the consequences of your beliefs. It's tough work of the mind, but you also do it with someone. As I said at the beginning, apologetics has not taken place until someone is listening, until someone's listening to your defense of the faith, your attack, your attraction. Takes place with someone, to someone, for someone. So we must be, in what we're doing, concerned for the person that we are reaching as much as the ideas that we are discussing. If you win the argument but not the person, in fact, you have lost. And lastly, encourage you as apologists to answer people's questions without closing the argument. People do want answers, and this surprises me. I think a little bit too prevaricating about what I offer people. I say, well, there's this view, that view, and that view. Do what you like. Actually, people like to hear what you think. They like to hear what your view of the universe is. They like to hear what it means for you to be a Christian and how you defend that particular set of doctrines that you hold to. But they don't like the door being shut in their faces. They want to hear answers to their questions, but they want them to be done in an open way that encourages further relationship and further opportunity and respects their freedom and human responsibility to make their own decisions. All right, well, you've been very patient. Whoops. Next stop is Narnia. Can I challenge you to think over the next few months about what you might do in your own context with this opportunity that comes up surrounding the Narnia film? It's out on December the 9th, so there'll be a build-up. How does it work with this defence, attack, attract model? Certainly it'll give you a chance to defend the Christian idea of sacrificing your life for another. I can't think of an easier entree to the heart of the gospel than this film. People will be going to hear, they'll be hearing a message of atonement in this film. How often will you get that? It's a great opportunity to defend the Christian idea. It's also a chance to attack, I think, on the marketing front. Have your eyes open to whether the marketing's undermining the message of the film. Its grace and mercy and kindness and childlikeness may be undermined by the pressure of the marketing. I don't know. I don't know what kind of control Douglas Gresham, who's C.S. Lewis's stepson, has been very involved, how much control he'll have. But we may be able to attack the worldview behind the marketing of the movie that suggests this is just a product for people to consume. And lastly, it's a chance to attract people to how well the Christian message makes sense of life. They see the film, they think it's a wonderful message. You can say, did you know that's an allegory of the Christian faith? Hopefully it will be within the film, and I'm led to believe it will be, that they have preserved well the content of the novel. It's a chance to attract people to the wonderful humanity that God has given us. The children in the story become kings and queens of Narnia. And the message of Christianity is that God wants us as kings and queens, as co-rulers with him of the universe, as inheritors of eternal life. What a fabulous message we have. And what a great way to be able to start to communicate this message. All right, well, you've really been very patient. Can I take 5 minutes of questions, or do you want to zip?
I think 5 minutes for questions is good.
Yep.
Strict 5 minutes.
Okay.
If possible, really quick.
Yep. There's some books that you can look at if you're interested while someone's thinking of the first question. A couple on... NarniaWeb.com. And the other one is a collection of research on C.S. Lewis. CSLewis.drzeus, Dr. Zeus, the Greek Zeus, .net.
Thank you.
So these books, there's one each on the... Defend, Attack, Attract approach, just ones that I think are useful. And two on the art of apologetics in the way I've been explaining it. You can come and look at those afterwards if you like.
You mentioned political humility, respecting other views, allowing them to make their own decisions in apologetics. It's very difficult to do that with postmodernists who always say, well, that's good for me, but I'm going to stick to my opinion.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I think the triple model of apologetics really helps there, because you can go so far in defending your view. People say, oh, that's just your view. But the attraction approach may be more fruitful. So if you have a debate with someone about whether it's better to remain faithful to your partner in a relationship or whether it doesn't matter, and then you can undergird your reasoning for that is your belief that God is faithful to us and that he says we should be faithful to each other. And that's kind of a different approach to an issue rather than getting into loggerheads over a doctrine or something like that. So, I think the attractive approach is very useful. It's because people's problem with Christianity is not always what they put forward as their problem either. So they may have a problem with, you believe the Bible's the word of God, how can you believe that? But behind that may be something else. And the attractive approach gets behind the initial questions, I think. Thanks, Tony. Yeah, no, I think that's true.
What's the technique you use just before you go into the apologetic mode?
Question is, what's the technique you use just before you go into the apologetic mode?
I'm not sure I understand what you mean.
You pray.
Oh, okay. Do I pray?
How do you prepare yourself?
Oh, right. Yeah. I have no technique whatsoever. My approach to life is an absorbent approach. In my whole life, I absorb the things I'm going to use, and I hope I can bring them to mind at the right time. I do pray. Last one.
You referred to the danger of culture heavy, isn't there?
Yes.
An equal danger of culture light.
Right.
I can remember seeing a Christian school teacher reading the Da Vinci Code.
Yes.
I referred her to a website we have in the UK called Damaris, which
yes.
does.
Yes, I know. They're very, very useful. Yeah.
And she said, tell me a novel.
Hmm. Yes, I think I take it as read here that everyone knows, but it's only a novel, doesn't cut it. That pop culture has enormous influence on people. That politicians listen to pop stars You know, you can get Bill Gates to stand on a Live 8 program because pop stars are there and people listen to music. And, you know, there's, yeah, I take it as read that we here would know that. But you're right. Some people would dismiss these expressions of the connections between Christianity and the world very quickly. And part of our job is to keep them on the agenda for people, to say this film really is an opportunity for you to talk about Christianity. The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe really is a chance for your church to do something. I think it's more people are on board with the project than were maybe 10 years ago and can see that culture really is a significant way into evangelism. Yeah, but I think your point's good.
Right. Final one.
Yep. Can I just recommend the Damaris website? I don't know it, but if you know it, but it's an excellent resource that they use to go through a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, it is. It is. The Damaris Trust in the UK, yeah. So once you've come and looked at the Case website, you can certainly go off and look at the Damaris website after that. Thanks.
Okay, Greg, we thank you very much. Would you please thank Greg?